What is the definition of space? The concept of space between two things seems to limit space, so how do we understand what it means in the context of Vedanta? Space is, in Vedanta, space is viewed as one of the five elements: space, air, fire, water, earth. And there's a reason for that particular order: space, and then air, then fire, then water, and earth. And it has to do with orders of subtlety. Okay? And so if we go start from prithvi, from the earth, that's considered the grossest in terms of subtlety, the least subtle. And that, one thing to how to understand that, it's the least pervasive, but it's also something, the earth, is something that is perceived by all five sense organs. In other words, the earth, you know, I can hear it. I drop it, I can hear it. I can feel it. I can see it. It has form. I can taste it. I can smell it. So all I have access to prithvi, to the earth, through all five of my sense organs. If I go up to water, I'm going up one level of subtlety. Water I can access through four of my sense organs, but not through the sense of smell. Water has no smell. Smell belongs to the earth. But water I can taste, I can see, it has form, you know, I can see it, I can feel it, and I can hear it, right? Now if I go up one more order of subtlety, now I'm losing access of two sense organs, because fire, the third one up, I can't taste fire and I can't smell fire. But I can see fire, I can feel fire, right? And I can hear fire, I can hear it crackle. So now it has only three sense organs that can access it, right? If I go up one more level of subtlety to vayu, to the wind, now I only have two access, because I can't see vayu. I can't see the wind, right? I can't see the wind, I can't taste the wind, I can't smell the wind, but I can feel the wind. And I can feel it against my skin, and I can hear it. I can hear the crackling of the wind. But now we go up to the last one, which is space, akasha. We go up to space, and space, for the sense organs, I have no access. Right? You can't smell space, you can't taste space, you can't see space, and you can't feel space. We say you can hear space, because I think back in those days, I don't know how you hear space, but that's really the only sense organ that's left over. And it's attributed to space as a quality of space, right? For whatever reason. Maybe because in a vacuum, maybe space travels, because sound can travel through space, whatever it is. But it's interesting to see this, these levels of subtlety. And what is more, that which is more subtle pervades what is less subtle. Space is the most subtle. And so space pervades everything. It's not like there's some space between this knee and this light. But not really, because this knee and this body and this lamp all exist within space, right? So there is no division. Any type of division of space is considered mithya, or a false division. It's considered a division that is caused by what we call the upadhi, the conditioning adjunct. Like, for instance, if I say, this is room space. This is room space. But from the standpoint of space, there's no room space, because space pervades the room, it pervades the building, it pervades the town, it pervades the earth, it pervades the whole solar system. Another example we use, just the all-pervasiveness of space in this waking state, I'll get to that later. We use the example often is if you have a pot, say you have a pot, and you move the pot from point A to B, right? Moving it back and forth. Is it carrying the space with it? Or is it moving through space? You know? So if I say with it, it's carrying the space with it, then when I go, I'm going to have to rip out a little piece of space to move it over here, right? There's no ripping of the space. Everything is, the space pervades everything. And so we all exist in space, and space exists in and through us. So space is considered in terms of this waking state that we experience, and in terms of the five elements, that element which is the closest to Brahman, which is the closest to being non-dual. It's not non-dual, but it's the closest to being non-dual. So let me just tell you for a few moments what we mean by non-dual and why space is the closest to it. Non-dual means that it's one without a second from three different standpoints. One is called, we would say, let me just look at duality first, and then this particular type of duality, which the Atma, or what that which is absolutely non-dual, has to be free of. We can start with the difference between species and species, or for you mathematicians, between sets. We have a set of things and another set of things and another set of things. Or we have one species, a species of trees, you know, of one type of tree, and a species of another type of tree, or a species of dog and a species of another type of dogs. So these are all sets or groups. And so one species is different from another species is different from another. So that's dvaita, that's duality. For something to be non-dual, right, there can only be one species. There can't be many. That's the first thing that has to go. Not one species, only not many species, only one species. But then say we have one species. So let's take the species of dogs, you know, the dog species. Okay. Now the problem is this one species, say all there exists is dogs, that's all. We have one species, but that one species has many members. So even though there's only one species, that one species has many parts. That is not non-dual, because there's more than one. Even though they're all the same species, there's more than one in that grouping. That's not non-dual. For it to be non-dual, there has to be one species that has only one member. But then it has one member, so there's only, say there's only one species of dog, and that dog's species has only one member. It has only one dog. Okay. But that one dog has many parts. Yeah. And so that's not non-dual. It has many parts. That's more than one. And so for something to be non-dual, it has to be only one species, which has only one member, and that one member can have no parts. That is non-dual. Absolutely, from every standpoint, it is one without a second. Now, space is the closest that can come to that. Because space, if you take space itself as a species, space has only one member. There are not two spaces, right? Because space is all pervasive. There's not two spaces, there's only one. And this one space has no parts. Right? So in two out of the three ways, space is non-dual. And we experience it that way too. We don't experience many spaces. We experience one space in which everything exists. So one all-pervasive space. And any division is a false division. It's mithya. It's an apparent division. It's not a real division. So space gives you some sense of non-dual. But space is not non-dual because there are species that are not space, which are the other four elements. Space is not fire. It is not water. It is not, you know, it's not air. It's not fire. It's not water. It's not earth. And so because of that, space is part of a group. Because it's part of a group, we can't consider it non-dual. But it has these qualities of non-dual, and so we can use space in Vedanta as a teaching tool, as a teaching example. Sometimes we'll say, Brahman is all-pervasive like space. Of course, it's different than that, because even though it's true that Brahman, the self, the Atma, is all-pervasive as being the material cause or the truth of all beings of the whole creation, it's all-pervasive like space. So any drishtanta that we use, any illustration that we use, it's not going to be perfect because it's an illustration. But it can highlight certain things. Like sometimes we use the sun as an illustration because the sun is self-luminous, right? You don't need to bring in, I've even used this in class, you don't need to bring in another sun to light up the sun because the sun is self-shining. So the sun can be an example, a drishtanta, for the nature of the self as being self-evident, self-luminous as consciousness. You don't need to bring in another consciousness to light up consciousness, just like the sun. So these illustrations are very, very useful. So now, in this question, what is the definition of space? Everything I've just said is our definition of space. That's how we define space descriptively. We don't have a scientific definition of space because it's not really necessary. In the Vedanta, the definitions that we use are, for the most part, descriptive definitions that help us differentiate the experiences that we are having. We can go into a scientific analysis of the Earth and all of the interrelationships and all the mathematics and all. Those are different paradigms and they're useful for what they are. But for us, we need to be able to differentiate with viveka the nature of the self from everything that can be objectified. And then we have to recognize the nature of anything that is objectifiable, that exists within time and space, understanding space is all pervasive, right? Then we have to come to the nature of the world that we perceive that is bound by change, what that actually means for something to be bound by change, as we'll see as we get into it, but if something is bound by change, it's subject to birth and death, and therefore has no being on either side of it. Right? It comes into being and goes out of being. And so then, therefore, it has no real independent existence of its own. So all of the words that we use are and ways of understanding the creation are descriptive, and then trying to understand them in terms of the level of reality that they enjoy. Right? Because we're looking for what is actually here. What is real? What is the substance, the being? What is the truth of this creation? So to find the truth of the creation, you have to first find what is here. Find something. You know, and as we analyze the creation that we experience, we find that anything that we are analyzing actually just becomes a name within names within names within names and goes into an infinite regress of name and form. So you end up negating the reality of the whole creation in order to discover the non-dual substance of the whole creation. So why I'm telling you all of this is just to kind of point out how we're using language and how the paradigms are used and for what. Because within the creation we have many different paradigms. We have math and we have science and we have so many, you know, biology. We have so many different ways of categorizing our experience and the interrelationships involved in our experience. We have so many different paradigms and models that allow us to do that. But all of those models serve a purpose that help us to gain knowledge in one way or another. So here, the paradigm that we use and the teaching methodologies that we use, their sole purpose really is understanding the nature of reality in terms of the truth of my own being and the truth of this creation. And so those are the paradigms, and they're mostly making us understand descriptively the experiences that we're having and seeing them in a way that we're not used to seeing. That's why this understanding of this viveka is so important. This discriminative analysis is so fundamental. Right? So I think that's the best I can do. Okay with it? About love. When we feel love for someone or something, it is because the nature of ourselves shines through when mind is still in content. So love for someone, something, is really you're experiencing yourself but projecting the love to something outside. Both of these paragraphs are really good. They're correct. I could even give a class on each one of these paragraphs. Okay, now, when falling in love, love becomes very intense and almost a sense of needing and desire. It is not very sattvic in my experience, more rajasic. Yes. So questions. One, psychologically, is the falling in love based on psychological needs from inner children that projects out to someone who meets those needs? And two, for jnani, does the sense of love become more sattvic and not neediness, a calmer love? And three, we'll just look at all the questions, then I'll go back to the first one. We comfort our inner children to take care of the mind and wounds. Do you think it is as effective as getting comfort from another human being? Isn't that what relationships are for, to comfort, support, and learn from each other? So sangha and friends, partners who can accept and love, is as healing as inner child work? Question mark. Good. All right. First question. Is the falling in love based on psychological needs from inner children that projects out to someone who meets those needs? Well, That can be involved. The inner children, or the ways that they weren't fulfilled or didn't get the love that they needed to feel whole and complete developmentally as they were growing up. Those needs do tend to be projected on your partner, the person that you end up falling in love with. But I would say that is the main reason that you fall in love with your partner. I think the main reason is having children, is Bhagavan. That you need this kind of glue, you know, and this type of strong falling in loveness, you know, to take place, to give you the type of union you need, you know, to create a family system. So that's going back kind of almost, it's not just psychological, it's almost archetypal. It's almost instinctual, the instinctual needs of the psyche. And from beginningless time, there's always so many rituals about mating, coming together, you know, forming a family, how to handle the children. There's all so many rituals involved around that, you know, and then the magical and very strong sexual attraction that is part of all of that, you know, that bring you together, that through so much energy bring you together in order to produce children to continue the species. So that's one way of answering the question. Now, on another level, why do you fall in love with this person and not this person? We can say from a Vedantic level, a karmic level, is that probably in your prarabdha karma, if in the karmas that, you know, are manifesting that take you through your life, if you are to get married in this life for some sort of long-term marriage and have children and all of that, that's probably very much in the karma with that particular person. Because that isn't, if it's not just a fling, you just have a quick affair or, you know, dalliance with somebody, that's different. That can just be what it is. It's not necessarily some big karmic issue. But when you are spending a good amount of time with a person, then the prarabdha karma has to be involved, right? Because you're living your life with that person and you're going through years of events with that person, or months and months and months and months of events with that person. So there's a shared karma there. And so I think that the prarabdha karma for both people involved, you know, becomes shared. And I think that that is something that is kind of ordained in a way in terms of the prarabdha karma of each of you meeting, you know. You know, an interesting story, it's kind of a personal story, but I have one person in my life, Edward, if you've listened to my tapes or anything, probably your classes, you always hear Edward. He's always there. He always is asking questions. He's never really missed a class. If something would have to be terribly wrong if he missed a class for the last 45 years. It's a long time. He's always there, always, always there. He's about 3 or 4 years older than me. Yeah, 4 years older than me. He was born about 2 blocks from me. Isn't that bizarre? And he knows exactly where my house used to be. He used to pass by my house on his bike when he was little. Yeah. So that's just so funny, you know, why would he be born there, 2 blocks from me, you know? And then all this kind of interconnectedness. And here this person has been with me for since my early 20s, you know, and basically never left my side, whether I wanted him to or not. No. Yeah, that's karma. That's a karma. So when the right person comes into your life, it's not like the life is a fairy tale or anything, and marriage, any kind of marriage, committed relationship is difficult. It just is. It's full of joy and it's full of everything. It's full of everything, you know. And in fact, Carl Jung would say, you know, it takes so much growth. To be in a relationship is really good because it forces so much growth, you know. Also, for the same reason, having children is so good because you have to grow. I mean, you have to become so big to give yourself so completely to another being like you do to a child. And all of the chemistry and everything involved, you know, forces that situation. And so you become big every time, you know, you have a commitment to another, whether it be your partner, you know, or it be your children, or to your whatever it happens to be. It forces bigness on your part. So to me, that's all Bhagwan, you know. Anyway, whoever your partner ends up being, the little ones inside will always be triggered. Because the little ones inside are incomplete. That's why they're inside. And they didn't get what they needed. They didn't get the love that they needed. They didn't get the support they needed. In one way or another, they are needing. And when they're needing, and yet you don't yet know to go in and be with them and be in dialogue with them, what happens is that their needs will project out on your partner, you know, just very, very naturally. And so the little children come in to play, you know, but I wouldn't say that they're always the reason for the attraction. You know, psychologically speaking, sometimes we say that it can be the reason for the attraction in an unhealthy situation where the little child part of you is trying to repair the relationship with the parent. And so the unfulfilled, the wanting to fix the relationship, that wanting to fix it, will end up land that one who wants to fix will then project the parental figure onto the partner, hoping that that partner will then be with me in the way that I need you to be with me when I was a little girl. Right? So that happens quite a bit. Now say, if, for instance, your parents were physically violent, physically abusive, violent, you know, very hurtful people. I want to say one of them was. You would always be trying as a little one, you know, before you have at the edge of reason, trying to fix that, trying to make them be pleased with you, trying to win their love, trying to win their attention in so many ways. Just instinctually you're doing that, trying to win them over, win them over. And you're not successful. Okay, so then you keep trying. The unconscious keeps trying to do that, you know. And so then you get a partner, and that little one is still trying to win over the father or win over the mother, you know. Because it needs that developmentally in order for it to grow and to mature, you know. And so it's continually trying to do that through projection. And so a lot of times in therapy, the therapists really work with a client around that and how to actually fulfill that need through different types of inner child work. Because otherwise it's just unconsciously projecting out on a person who they think they might be able to win over. Now often that person, if say for instance the father, was a really abusive man, then you may be attracted to an abusive man, you know, so that you can win him over, because you weren't successful with your father, so now maybe you can be successful with this man who's acting just like your father, like that. It gets kind of tricky in the psychological level, like that. You know? And so we have our own prarabdha karma, but then we have the pratibhasika, means the subjective inner realities that are trying to work themselves out within the creation also. Let's see if I can do any better with that one. So is the falling in love based on psychological needs from the inner children that projects out to someone who meets those needs? I would say a lot of times it's much deeper than that. It has to do with the power of the karma, but that is also something that definitely comes up, as I've been talking about. Two. For a jnani, does the sense of love become more sattvic and not neediness, calmer love? Definitely, it does. Because with knowledge, for one who has knowledge, has matured into their knowledge, the source of love is known. It's now not subject to projection anymore. In other words, even though there can be projections taking place, I can happily go after that projection, not for happiness, because the mind is already situated in my own being, right? It doesn't mean that in the world is all of a sudden dries up of all attraction, and it doesn't mean that you have no desires. You do have desires. That's what keeps you going. You do have preferences. You do have people that you're attracted to, and other people that's absolutely neutral, and other people that you're not attracted to. All of those things are there. But they're non-binding desires, and what makes them non-binding, they don't need to be fulfilled for your happiness. Because the mind has differentiated, has discerned, and has found the nature of your own being as the very ananda or the wholeness that you've been projecting onto the world and then running after. So you've discovered it, you found it. And so the mind that has discovered that more and more just loves to be with that wholeness and then be with the world as Ishvara, out of that fullness, you know, not for that fullness. If you're in the world, every time you're in the world or have a relationship with someone or something so that I can be happy, that's very treacherous, you know, because if I really believe that, I need that so that I can be happy, it's very upsetting when the obstructions come. If you need something so that you can be happy, so you think, and there's no obstructions, then you don't notice the frightening nature of that desire. But if the desire is not fulfilled, then you get very upset. It's very, very upsetting if it's a real desire. And then people become your enemies because they're taking something very precious, very important away from you. In fact, they're taking yourself away from you because you projected yourself out onto the object or the person or whatever it may be, and then they're sabotaging that. They're trying to take that away from you. And you may not be able to stop them either. And so your mind will get exceedingly upset if it's a real desire. If it's just a little preference or like or something, you might be a little bit upset, but you don't care that much because it's not that big of a desire. But if it's a real desire, you know, or that's really important to you, then you'll feel a lot of pain and anger and rage and fury to when those obstructions come up. It's actually very, very upsetting, you know. So we don't want that. It is much nicer life. It's what we call moksha, or liberation, actually. To have discovered that the very ananda or love that I'm seeking in the world, you know, is just a projection of the wholeness of my own being. And now my mind, instead of running out here trying to find that, you know, just revels in my in the love itself, and then lives my life, the life the prarabdha karma has given you. And you live it as Ishwara. This is Ishwara, this is my life, I do my best. They say that taking a birth on this plane of existence, this human plane, is 50-50, punya and papa. 50-50. Punya means the karmas that create beautiful situations for you, pleasing situations. Papa are the manifestation of the karmas that create difficult situations or painful situations. So no matter what, whether you have self-knowledge or, you know, you're a samsari living, you know, trying to make yourself happy through fulfilling desires, it's not going to be a picnic. It's not like you get knowledge and then everything is just smooth sailing from there on. No. There's still all these obstacles and obstructions, you know, and things that need to be done and things that are difficult and all of that. But your well-being is at stake, so you have some objectivity. Okay, this is a hard situation. What's the best way to handle this? It's not like, you know, that's not there. That part's not there. It doesn't mean the situations are easy. You know, I was with Swamiji for many, many years, and I've seen him handle really, really difficult, very, very difficult situations. But he's so objective. It was a difficult situation, and he figured out what is the best way to handle this and deal with this, and that's what he did. He's never, his ananda or his wholeness, his well-being, was never at stake at all. But it's not that the situation didn't require, you know, a lot of work to handle, and some people upset, and to calm people down, and all that, and, you know, would work with whatever's there. But his own well-being was not at stake. And so as you yourself, as you become more and more in touch with your own nature, you know, you gain more what we call vairagya, that projection starts falling off. The projection of ananda onto the world just slowly starts becoming less and less and less. And as it becomes, those projections become less and less and less, the more shanti my mind enjoys naturally. Because if I'm not asking the universe to be different, then there's nothing to get upset about. You know, if I'm not asking you to be different so that I can be happy, you know, that your behavior is what it is, I have to deal with it in whatever way I have to deal with it, you know, but I'm not at stake, so I can actually deal with it, the behavior and the situations that come up in a way that is dharmic and objective and helpful and not, you know, vengeful and vindictive and, you know, hurtful, because there's nothing, those type of really destructive feelings aren't being drawn out. Those very destructive feelings are drawn out because of pain. You know, they're a reaction to pain. They're a reaction to a thwarted desire, always. When you're feeling, one really beautiful question to ask yourself is when you're feeling that anger, you know, or upset. And just ask yourself, what desire, what is it that I really want that's being obstructed? And then really go into that and see, get in detail, what is it that I'm really wanting here that is being obstructed? And let that part of yourself tell you what that is. You know? And then you can see if there's some solution to that. You know? Maybe there's another way around this problem. You can bring in your knowledge. But the first thing is to really understand, you know, what's causing, what raga, you know, what raga has been, or dvesha, you know, has been obstructed. And why? Why is it so important? And usually it always resolves and always comes down to this person, by taking away this, is taking away my happiness in the form of this. They're taking away my happiness. And to whatever degree that projection is real for you, that degree we suffer. Because the happiness and yourself are one and the same thing. The very source of the ananda is your own being. So your own being is as though being taken away from through that projection. Three, we comfort our inner children to take care of the mind and wounds. Do you think it is as effective as getting comfort from another human being? Isn't that what relationships are for, to comfort, support, and lead, and learn from each other? So sangha and friends, partners who can accept and love, is as healing as inner child work. Well, part of this, there's just something to add to this. Like, I totally feel myself that human relationships and friendships and all are just a really important, rich part of our life, our relationships, our community, our sangha. They create, you know, that humanity, what human beings are social, we're social creatures, you know, and we need family and relationships and friendships. We're not isolates for the most part, you know. So we need each other. That's just part of being a human being. And so if you're in a sangha and you have friends and partners who accept and love you, that itself is in a sense essential in this way, that for just a person. Not as essential for a jnani, but it's essential for just the human makeup. Heinz Kohut, who is a very famous psychologist in the modern era, he created the psychology called self-psychology. For some of you are psychologists, you might know of him. But you know what he said? He said that mirroring is the oxygen for the soul. So just like the human body needs oxygen to live, the psyche, the soul, needs mirroring. You know what mirroring is? It's more of a psychological term we use in the therapy world. But mirroring is something we do very, very naturally. Like, if you're telling me something, say a story about something that just happened to you, then I would be, if I'm mirroring, naturally mirroring without thinking about it, I would be listening and kind of responding emotionally to the story naturally. You know, in my facial expression, in my bodily expression, it would be mirroring the affect that was coming to me from the one who was telling me the story or telling me the situation. Or on a simpler level, if somebody greets me and gives me a big smile, it would be absolutely natural, almost unconscious, for me to greet them and give back that same type of smile. So that there's mirroring, you know? That's mirroring. Now say somebody comes and says, hello, you know, how are you? So happy to see you. And I just go, awkward. Very awkward. Yeah. And unnatural. The person doesn't know what to do. You just kind of disappear. You want to just disappear and run away. Because mirroring is not there. In the 40s, early 50s, I think they did an experiment where they would take a mother with her newborn. Newborn means just a few months old. just a baby that they'd put the baby in the mother's lap like this. And then the baby would be looking at the mom, mother, and trying to, you know, the goo goo goo, and trying to get attention and all that. And the mother was instructed to just look stonewall. No expression. By the way, these are illegal experiments. They could never be done today. They still have films of it. And if you're training to be a psychologist, they show these films. Just so you can, but they could never do something like this. Anyway, the baby at the beginning would just start trying a little more. So see, we're talking a little infant. They did a little more to get mom's attention, you know, and then a little more and smiling and goo-gooing and all of this kind of stuff. Mother not getting any attention. And the baby would start not realizing it wasn't happening and would start getting upset. And then it would get more upset and more upset until that little baby just, but what they say, it just absolutely decompensated. It just went berserk, berserk, because it couldn't get met, you know? And that meeting, even as adults, we require it. We require that, or it's very, very disconcerting, you know? And so that's why Kohut says, for adults, not just for little babies, but for adults themselves, that mirroring is the oxygen of the soul. The soul requires that type of being met, you know? We need that. So, that being the case, these human relationships we have are so important, you know? And being able to give to others and receive from others, just that humanity makes us human. But now the other side of this, so I'm totally feel that way, and I think it's also scientifically, there's a lot of proof around that. But now it says, do you think it is as effective as getting comfort from another human being? I think that inner child work can be more effective than being with a human being, in terms of healing the inner child, for you to go in and be in relationship with that inner child. And the reason for that is you know that inner child. You know how old they are. You know exactly what their needs are. You know that it's 2 years old or 3 years old, or, you know. You know what it's hurting, is hurting it, because that inner child was you. Now you as the adult can go in and be with that inner child and satisfy the needs of that child. Whereas your friends and even your partner can help you, can mirror you and soothe you, the adult. But they don't know about the inner child. They don't know the inner child. You know? And the inner child is, if the inner child is coming out, they just see you acting like a child. They don't know that's the inner child. You know, whereas if the person comes into a therapeutic relationship with a therapist, then the therapist can be with all aspects of the psyche and can recognize the inner child, respond to the inner child, and then have the adult learn how to actually be with that part of yourself in a very, very healing way. So I think actually it can be very disappointing, highly disappointing, for the little ones inside, when the partner or the friends aren't responding to me on that level, you know? And I can understand that when I myself am in relationship with the little ones on that level, but the little ones on that level, when they are triggered and they come up and overwhelm my own conscious mind, then my partner is not responding to the little one that has overwhelmed my mind. They're responding to me, the adult, who is acting like a little one. You know? So that little one can just continue to be hurt. Right? So I would say that in a way that inner child work is necessary and unique and important, you know, and cannot really be replaced by the Sangha. But on the other hand, the Sangha, the friendships, the relationship, the family, familial life, whatever it is, that we have, all of those things are very valuable, necessary as a human being, you know, to be in a sangha, in a group of friends, have friends who really mirror you and love you and care about you. You know, that's human. Please talk about adhikaritvam and antakarana shuddhi. What is it and how to increase it? What happens when the mind is expanded so that it feels like the body exists inside the mind? What is taking place then? Okay. This word adhikaritvam means that state, the tvam, the state of being a qualified student for Vedanta, right? And the adhikaritvam and the antakarana shuddhi, the purity of mind, have some things in common. But the adhikari, say if a person, so we'll do the adhikari first. Say a person comes to this knowledge, is a mumukshu, means they have a desire for this knowledge. When they listen to the teaching, their mind goes, oh, you know, it's as though you've found something. So that desire to listen, to learn, to understand is there and can be quite strong. Yeah. That person is going to have a good amount of the qualifications of an adhikari, or you would not even get near this teaching. Your friend might drag you to the classroom and you think, within 10 minutes, oh my God, the person goes like, ow, please don't do this to me again. Yeah. Because that state of being a student who's ready for this particular type of teaching is not there for that person. It's not interesting. But for a mumukshu, one who really has that yearning for liberation, these qualities will be there in some measure, enough measure to make you an adhikari for this teaching. The first one is called viveka, which we're dealing with now. Viveka, from the standpoint of a student who just comes to this knowledge, means that I have recognized clearly that everything in my experience, without exception, everything that I am aware of, everything that comes into my field of awareness, is anitya. Anitya means it's time-bound. It's subject to change. It comes as birth, subject to birth and death. And I realize that clearly. I realize that there is no exception to it. That everything is like that, including my body, my mind, my sense organs, everything about me is like that. Everything I experience is like that. And then I realize, I make this little thing, if that is so, that everything in the universe is bound by time, means short-lived, as a beginning and an end, there is no possibility for me gaining any lasting wholeness or fullness from the creation. Because there's nothing in the creation that is lasting. So the creation is not able to give me a lasting state of well-being. Even my poor mind is impossible for the mind by its very nature to have any kind of a lasting state. Nor have I ever experienced it. We've experienced probably every emotion in the book or close to, you know, and all kinds of happiness and joy and all of these type of things, but they're always finite. And then at some point I realized not only are they always finite, they always will be finite, not through any fault of my own. So, but by the very nature of the creation. So that is what we call viveka in reference to my experience. I don't recognize the nityatvam, the eternality or changelessness of the self, because I don't know myself. I only know myself through these things that are anitya, that are time-bound. So when a person gains knowledge, that viveka becomes complete. Not only do I recognize the non-eternality of everything in the world, I also recognize the timelessness of my own being. That viveka is complete, but I start out with that half of it. That viveka leads to the next quality that we call vairagya. Vairagya means once I have that viveka, my passion for achieving some things in the world dims a little bit. Because now I know that I can achieve these things, but I may not be achieving what I really want, which is to be a whole and complete full person. That no achievement can really give me that. It can just give me time-bound experiences, that's all. And so none of it's going to help me to become, to say, now I've made it. Now I'm a whole and complete person. You know, I've kind of matured, I've fully flowered into the being that I'm supposed to be. Instead, what we find as we grow or as we live, we have moments of recognition of that whole, complete person that keeps eluding us. See it, we have it, it goes away. We know it is there. And now we realize that that which I know is there, we have no way to reach that. There's no way to get that out of the creation. And so that gives me a different relationship with the creation. I'm no longer asking it to give what it can't give. That gives a certain amount of vairagya. And I'd say that probably the vairagya, the level of vairagya, has to be enough to bring me to this knowledge, which is probably one of the weakest links. You know, because I come to this knowledge with still a lot of desires that slowly drop off. Where the viveka is probably much stronger, the vairagya is strong enough to bring me to this knowledge. But it's something that matures as my understanding increases. The fourth one, the third I'll get to do last, the fourth one is called mumukshutvam. If the viveka and vairagya is there, then that mumukshutvam, that desire for liberation comes, because I realize that I can't get what I want from the world. But I know that what I want exists, because I've seen it, I've experienced it. I know myself. But then, how do I get myself? How do I get that? Where is it? Where am I? As you know. Yeah. And so then I gain a desire for liberation. Then these three qualities themselves, the viveka, vairagya, and mumukshutvam, really bring me to a teacher. And they also help me on my way to certain qualities of the mind. The first quality, and each one of these qualities mature into an absolute level. The first one is shama. Shama means that as thoughts and feelings and emotions come into my mind, I have a choice to let them go on their way or to engage with them. I have the choice. But so often we don't have the choice. An emotion comes and bam, it's embodied. It's not like I say, no, you just go in your way, it's okay, I don't want to really engage with you, it's not where I want to go. No, it grabs you. The shama is that ability to have some choice over the thoughts and feelings of the mind, freedom to let them go. Dhamma is the ability to contain those thoughts and emotions that didn't go. They didn't want to go. They've grabbed you. You're contained by that. You're held by that emotion. Dhamma is the ability to be with it without acting it out. You know, because those emotions and reactions that have grabbed you create a lot of pressure inside. They want to express themselves. Either they want to express themselves through irritation or through anger or through gossip or through physical violence. Because the pressure. You know? So Dhamma is the ability to contain that and then to do inner work with that which you're able to contain without acting out. Upadati is really a type of sannyasa. Sannyasa means because of the viveka and vairagya, I become single-pointed in my mumukshutvam, in my desire for liberation. That's what is most important to me. And it can't be really displaced by another desire. It's not that I don't have other desires and I have my work and the things and my relationships and things I need to do in life. But those don't compete with the fundamental desire of gaining self-knowledge. That's upadati. So in a way, you don't have to take sannyasa to have that, but you are as though a sannyasi in that this is what is primary for you and nothing can knock it off, right? Even though you do many other things. Because in life, even a sannyasi who's wearing the orange, who's a mahatma, They do so many other things, you know, but those other things are not primary to them. So your knowledge or your mumukshutva, mujignasa, the desire for knowledge becomes primary. That's upadati. Titiksha is because what is primary for me is gaining knowledge and gaining that antakaran shuddhi, or that purity of mind, so that I can really hold my knowledge. That's what's primary. So that the pairs of opposites that the creation throws at me, you know, I can accommodate. Like say, I really was looking forward to going skiing this weekend, and now it's raining up there. It's all slush. No skiing. Skiing is out. Okay, skiing's out. It's because it's raining. Let's do something else. Or I could have a temper tantrum because, you know, the rain has come and ruined my skiing. You know? Titiksha is I can accommodate all of the opposites that the creation throws my way. Yeah, it's okay. Because what is primary for me really is gaining knowledge and antakarana shuddhi. So it's not okay, it's a sadhana. Okay? So that's that titiksha, that be able to handle the ups and downs and the things that the events, the happy events and the sad events that come my way. And then the things like hot and cold. It's hot when I want to be cold, and it's cold when I want it to be hot. And ruining my vacation days, all of this.
Yeah.
That's titiksha. Samadhanam is the ability of the mind to focus. Like say, if you're reading a book, how many paragraphs can you read before your mind wanders off? You know? Or you're listening to a talk. How attentive can you, what capacity do you have for your mind to actually be present for that talk? That's samadhanam. If I'm contemplating, how much capacity does the mind have to be single-pointed or to be focused? I'm not talking about an intention either. Just mean to sit with the subject matter, or to sit with myself, or to sit in class and have my mind available. That's samadhanam. And then the last one, and sometimes considered the most important for Vedantin, is shraddha. And shraddha is that blessing. It's that faith pending understanding. Something allows you to stay and begin this thorough study, not without any way of proving that it works. There's just something that holds you, that rings true, that allows you to stay with it. Or that your teacher knows what he or she is talking about. Because until you know, you can't know that your teacher knows. You don't even really know what your teacher knows, you know, until you yourself know, right? And so that requires some faith, what we call faith pending understanding, that allows you to sit and invest in a teaching with some faith, unknown knowing, something like that, that can allow you to see that through. It's called shraddha. It's considered to be a grace of Ishwara, anugraha, the grace of God, because you don't have the ability to choose that, because you don't know. You don't know what the vision of the Upanishads is. You don't know what the teacher knows. You know, so there's just something that gives you, internally, that gives you a go-ahead. That's called shraddha. So this group of six, plus the viveka, vairagya, and mumukshutva, are what we call the sixfold, the samadhi shatka. But it's called the sadhana chatushtya. It's really the fourfold sadhanas that qualities the mind has to have to have any interest even in this knowledge. So that's important. And then for the antakarana shuddhi, as this knowledge takes place, there's also in the teaching itself so many ways, so many attitudes, like the whole karma yoga attitude, how to do inner child work, how to recognize the creation as Ishvara, how to accept all of the results of your actions with the prasada buddhi, accepted as, you know, as coming from Bhagavan. There's so many things that are taught to help you learn how to be with your mind, to give it a very natural shanti, a natural sense of well-being that continues to deepen in the light of your knowledge, right? And so all of these, we're doing a lot of different things, and will be covered just in class, and a lot of things are covered in the meditations. It just should hopefully become second nature to you. As you learn what we do in the meditations, then those things you just keep doing. You don't just do it in meditation, it's just how you are, you know? Like if there's some big reaction, instead of going after the person, you go inside and say, what's really going on? What's this really about? Talk to the little ones inside. If you have hatred for somebody, then you do some inner work. We'll do some meditations during this week. You do some inner work around that relationship and how it came to this point to produce this type of hostile relationship. And it takes a lot of real honesty and being very real with yourself and with your feelings and with your needs and what you actually want. And it's very beautiful because it's so effective. It helps so much. Then you have to learn all. You have to just learn these things. And you have all the tools you need to really help the mind mature and grow and, you know, work on yourself.
Excuse me, Rana. Mm. Swamiji defines Shraddha as faith pending verification.
That's a good way of saying it. For me, when I was teaching me, it was always faith pending understanding, but what he means by understanding is when you actually see it. Yeah. You're saying verification, but what is the verification is taking place? You see it. Mm. You recognize it. You have that jnana nishtha, you understand that, you have no more doubts. Faith pending verification is fine. But you have to talk about verification, just like I have to talk about understanding. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Our time is up. We have one more question left. And we'll do, wait a minute. What have I done? Okay, we'll work this out later. I think I've got everything mixed up. Oops. Let's do a prayer. Let's see if that's your mind.
Om Swasti Prajapya Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishah O Brahmane Shubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parjanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Bharahitaha Ramana Santu Nirbhayaha Om Sarvesham Swastir Bhavatu Sarvesham Shantir Bhavatu Sarvesham Purnam Bhavatu Sarvesham Mangalam Bhavatu Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kaschit Dukkhabhag Bhavet Asato Ma Satgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritam Gamaya Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Hari Om Shri Rupyo.